Good morning. This is All Sides Weekend, Chefs in the City. I'm Marilyn Smith, along with WOSU restaurant reviewer and historian Steve Stover. Doug Motes and Christine Hayes are the authors of Lost Restaurants of Columbus. The book is published by American Palette. It's a division of History Press. We're delighted to have you at the table for the entire hour. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
What made you decide that you wanted to write about restaurants?
Doug made you decide. He started it.
Yeah, I had co-written a book with David and Elise Myers and Jeff Chenault on the history of the Kahiki. And that had done so well that the editor approached me and said, hey, would you be willing to write something about the Hi Lai? Because I also write a sometime history column for Columbus Underground, and I had done a story about the old Hi Lai restaurant. And I said, well, the Hi Lai is amazing, and we could do something with that. I said, but I don't know that it merits an entire book in the same way that the Kahiki did. I said, how about if we did some different restaurants and include some recipes and things? And our editor really thought that sounded like a fun idea, and so it came from there.
Was it fun? Was the project fun?
It was great fun, especially working with Christine. I think that was the smartest thing I did, was to ask her to come along this book journey with me. So, yeah, we found out all kinds of things that we didn't know. We got to dig through lots of archives and read through all kinds of amazing things, even from the 1890s and onward. And I thought it was great. I had a great time.
So once the two of you got together, how did you decide how you were going to approach this? Did you do it by age? Did you do it alphabetically?
What we focused on were the restaurants we could find the most information about. We know there's many other restaurants we can do, and we would love to hear everybody's stories about them. But when we got the research, we wanted to find as much as we could and find the quirkiest stories and the restaurants that people really loved. I helped Doug and the Grumpy Gourmet write the foreword. Then I got Doral Chenoweth, and I started writing a few more things and sending them to Doug. And finally, he said, "Why don't you just help me write?
Please help me write this book." I think it was, "Please help me write this book."
And then we made a list of all the restaurants that we thought should be included, and it seemed like a easy process to just split them up and start writing.
So I've opened the book to page one, and it begins with The Circus Chef, which is 1957 mm-hmm. to 1988. Why did you decide to put that one first? There are some much older restaurants that you've
heard
about. Well,
it was a much-loved diner, and it had the most amazing sign that said "Eat," that was a beckoning for truck drivers and everyone in the south end of Columbus. And Mike Harden wrote a wonderful article about them, and that's where I took a lot of it, and also from an article by Doral Chenoweth.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting when we were looking at restaurants, because the earliest that we cover is Marzetti's. And Marzetti's gets started in about 1896. And the last restaurant that we covered was Betty's. And Betty's closes in 2014. So we didn't do a chronological, this is the first, mm-hmm. and kind of a march through time. We really tried to take it as, okay, what are the diners that we're talking about? What are the kind of themed restaurants? What are the chain restaurants? We call it lavish dining, you know, the nicer
fine dining.
The fine dining. And we broke it up into chapters that way. And again, there was such a giant list. We covered just shy of about four dozen restaurants in here. And there's easily four, five, six, you know, you name the restaurants that don't get covered. And we've got a whole other book that we could be working on as
and
well.
And are you?
We're talking about it. Yeah.
Once we get the holidays over with, and we'll start researching again.
Well, I think it's wonderful because you're preserving this history and the people that know about these things and remember these places and have been to these places are, you know, getting older and passing on. And it's wonderful, I think, that you're preserving this forever.
Well, particularly since it seemed to me as I was reading the book, there was an abundance of fires that took these places
yeah.
out. It's not as though they're preserved in
yes,
some other
some
form
of them
today.
Under suspicious circumstances. Mm-hmm. So you never know. It's a hard business. I have great respect for anyone who runs a restaurant.
Absolutely. It was funny. I remember I was looking at something on Facebook and at the demise of Rigsby's, and people were really kind of quarterbacking what happened and what happened. And after Christine and I had written the book and we talked about the demise of I still don't have a rhyme or reason. And we've kind of gone through 48 plus, you know, well-known restaurants. So there's lots and lots of reasons why restaurants stop business.
And you mentioned the Hi Lai, which was a wildly popular place. I remember even when I came to town, that's where people went. It was on Olentangy River Road by then.
Yes.
But talk a little bit about the history of the Hi Lai. It started out in the Short North.
Yeah, it was right there on the cap.
There was no cap then.
Well, there was no cap then, yeah, but it was there. And Jap Watring is the man who had started it. It was right after Prohibition, and it really kind of started out as a bar. He knew that Prohibition was going to be repealed, and I think it opens up like just a few days. I could go to the book and look at it. But yeah, I mean, it starts out there, and much
it was
like
within a week, really.
Yeah,
it was
much,
a very short period.
Yep, and much like the old Mohawk, where they've got the turtle soup, there was a big sign out in front of the Hi Lai that said, you know, turtle soup available. And we talked to his daughters or his granddaughters, Jap Watring's daughters. They called themselves the Termites, Sherry, Terry, and
Jerry.
Well, they were
my childhood friends.
They were buddies of Christine's. So it was really great. I mean, to Steve's point, we were able to talk to the people who went there. I mean, they talked about when the Hi Lai moved from the cap, where the cap is now, from High Street to Olentangy.
It's around Poplar and High or something like that.
It's literally kind of like right where the cap is.
It's between Good Ale and
Poplar. So this was before they tore down Flytown.
Exactly.
And put in the freeway.
Yep. Yes. And they moved it, and they said that their grandfather would only take one of them at a time to the Highland Olentangy because he couldn't carouse them. Because they were so. But I mean, there's
little girls together. That's just
they
trouble.
Were high energy.
Yeah. And one of my favorite stories, I think, that I highlighted, if you don't mind if I read a little bit from the book, would that be okay? So, and this actually comes from Ben Hayes. I think Ben Hayes is kind of a third author along, and a fourth author would be the Grumpy Gourmet, and then even a fifth author, Tommy Thompson.
Well, mention the connection between Christine and Ben Hayes.
Well, Christine can talk about that.
Well, he's my father, and he has a wonderful file down at the Ohio Historical Society, or Ohio Historical Connection, and you can go read his files, and that's what Doug and I took a lot of things from there.
So, and he was an old CJ columnist.
He was a newspaper man in Columbus for 43 years. The Journal, then the Citizen Journal.
And I'm sure many people remember his name.
Right. And well, he also wrote for Ohio Magazine.
Yeah. I mean, and Ben Hayes was kind of a regular at the Hi Lai. He and Jap were good friends. And so was Ben's cousin, Woody Hayes. So when you think of the Hayes family, the Hi Lai restaurant is kind of a big deal. So I'll read this little bit. This is a Ben Hayes story. The first waiter to wear badge number one at the Hi Lai was named Johnny Richardson, or Big Johnny, as he was called. Another waiter, John Woodruff, was Little Johnny. And every night it was his duty to take care of the nightly deposits. Originally, the saloon had a safe, but one night burglars hauled it away. So Jap gave Richardson the job to hide the money somewhere different each night. As the story goes, one night he decided to hide the money in the oven. The next morning he came in a little late, and Ted the cook had already arrived and fired the oven up. Richardson knew this was a big problem, and he asked the cook if he had seen a bag of money in there. Ted the cook let him sweat it out for about 5 minutes before answering that, in fact, he had seen it, removed it. Johnny likely let loose a cacophony of swear words, but the deposits were once again safe and sound. So, I mean, it's great stories like that, you know, who hides money in the restaurants these days? Maybe they do. I don't know.
We're talking with Doug Motes and Christine Hayes, along with our restaurant reviewer, Steve Stover. Doug and Christine are the authors of Lost Restaurants of Columbus, and we will have them with us for the entire hour. What happened to the Hi Lai? It was, as we say, very popular. Many, many people went there, including your famous, second cousin,
yes.
And at one point, you tell a little story in there. I think it was during the 1974 football season that there were at least rumors that the restaurant was helicoptering people over to the stadium for the games.
It's true. I got to speak with Dave Gervis, and Dave Gervis was the final owner of the High Line. And you'll know the Gervis family as well from Gervis Brown Derby, which is another restaurant that didn't get included, but his family had the Gervis Brown Derby chain that was here. And it was always one of Jap's kind of fantasies or ideas to run a flotilla of boats up the Olentangy from the High Line to OSU and ferry people back and forth for OSU football games. Well, that couldn't come to pass. But in 1974, maybe it was an idea for some publicity, but they did. They actually helicoptered patrons. You could sign up and do this. You could have your lunch at the High Line and then board a helicopter, and they would helicopter you to right off next door to Ohio Stadium and then go in and see the football game.
So was there a helipad there, or were they just dropping people?
Well, I don't know about at Ohio Stadium, but if you remember the old High Line, you could park your car on top of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So they would actually kind of lift off right from on top of the restaurant. And then,
there was actually a pad.
Yeah, you could go right up there.
Mm-hmm. So how much of the showmen are restaurateurs? You know, it's not just cooking good food. It's also attracting people to your restaurant and competing with all the other restaurants that are after the diner's dollar.
Think about Benny Klein down there at Brontai. He was out there, and he was everywhere in his restaurant and out on the street and bringing people in and being like a barker and doing business at his special little table. I mean, the days of those kind of restaurateurs, I'm not sure that's continued, because people came to see the owner of the restaurant.
Well,
and he knew everyone's name. It was like the Cheers thing. You know?
But it does
continue. Chefs are rock stars.
Right. And so even Chef Hankey would visit the Hotel Concierge.
There are exceptions.
From time to time. And so everybody knows the importance of getting your message out and getting people into the restaurant. There's the food.
Mm-hmm.
There's the front of the house, which people sometimes forget about. And then there's the business side. So you have to be good at all three to have a successful restaurant.
Sure. Or I think of David Peltzman, who had David's on Main before Out on Main and then Brownstone on Main. Mm-hmm. And he was quite a showman. And in fact, he was the very first restaurateur. He made the cover of the National Enquirer. He sued patrons for not coming in for New Year's Eve dinner.
Sued them.
Yeah, he sued. I'll read you this chapter. Always outspoken, David was the first restaurateur to sue a patron over a missed New Year's Eve dinner reservation. The lawsuit gained national exposure, with David appearing on local TV broadcast, Good Morning America, and even the April 14th, 1994 edition of the National Enquirer. The suit was eventually settled, and the patron in question gave a sizable donation to the Mid-Ohio Food Bank. And typically grand manner, David told the Columbus Dispatch, "I don't care how much it was. It was a win for me because he rolled over. It was because of my generosity and my largesse." So David was pretty grandiose in that way. So.
Well, you've certainly heard about people charging for dinner that may have been missed, especially on a busy night like New Year's Eve. But suing is certainly a big step.
He did it.
Not bringing a good positive.
Maybe not, but he certainly got a lot of attention for it. So it does. I think there are a lot of the restaurateurs that we talk about that have very large personalities. Benny Klein, I think of Jap Watring. Or there are those that also have kind of big person, or Danny Scher, Danny Deeds at the Merrimore. The Scher family had that, but Danny Deeds was certainly a showman. In fact, he took the Merrimore and turned it into kind of a nightclub cabaret where the Smothers Brothers would come in and Phyllis Diller would come in and different things like that. So,
and downtown was a destination. You know, people went downtown all the time. There was Lazarus, and then you'd go to dinner or lunch, and you know, then suddenly the trend
Keenings,
went to the
Mills,
suburbs.
Mills Cafeteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, of course, going downtown was an event. You got dressed up.
Yeah, and you had your white gloves on, and you went out to dinner or lunch and went shopping. Nowadays, not so much.
We're talking with the authors of Lost Restaurants of Columbus, Christine Hayes and Doug Motes, along with Steve Stover. We are going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back, and we'd love to hear from you. Good morning, I'm Marilyn Smith. This is All Sides Weekend, Chefs in the City. We're talking this morning with Doug Motes and Christine Hayes. They're the authors of Lost Restaurants of Columbus, along with Steve Stover, who does restaurant reviews for WOSU on our blog, Chefs in the City, at WOSU.org. Steve is also the author of prodigious lists of historic restaurants here in Columbus.
Thank you.
We talked a little bit about your dad being a columnist for several newspapers. You also, in the book, there are pictures of you with your mother and father out to dinner at various restaurants. Were you always included in this adult kind of company?
Yes, my parents took me everywhere. I didn't know I was supposed to act like a kid. I was just a little downtown kid, and I had to look everybody in the eye and say yes and no. And I just was there at Broad and High looking at the Roy's Jewelers sign, you know, being mesmerized by this beautiful cascading champagne bubble lights there. And my favorite was walking into the High Line. Walter Nick played there, and he would, my theme song was Thumbelina, and he would play that when I would walk into the High Line. So I thought all kids were like that.
Well, when that's the way you're raised, you don't know any different.
Right, I didn't know any different.
So
I named my dolls after waitresses. There was a waitress named Cora Beaver, and I kid you not, I'm not making this up, at Seafood Bay. And we went there once a week and had lobster, and I always ate shad roe as a child. And I sat up at the bar, and I watched the turtles swimming in the aquarium. There was an aquarium that was, you could see it from the street and from the bar. It was clear glass window with fish and turtles. So I would sit at the bar until my shad roe came, and then I would sit at the table with the adults
and sip your Shirley Temple.
Oh, yes. Shirley Temple, always. Yes.
And musical introductions weren't anything. It wasn't just specifically for the High Line. Vivian at the organ also did that at the Claremont for umpteen years. Depending upon what you were, she might play a favorite song that she knew or whatever. So I think that's also great fun that you had a theme song, Christine.
Yes. And you have a BBF theme song, I think.
I do. The BBF theme song is in here. let me find the words to it real quick. Here it is. Everybody's going to the BBF and taking their appetite. Everybody's going to the BBF at the Whirling Satellite. You can eat them there. You can take them home, and entertaining can be fun. Let BBF be your party chef. Serve a banquet on a bun. For those of you who don't remember the old BBF Burger Boy Foodorama.
And I danced at Jerry Razor's Teen Dance-a-Rama on TV. And we went there on Saturday mornings and did that. And they were the advertisement. And we would get coupons and go eat BBF stuff after we danced.
Now, remind people who may not have grown up in Columbus during that era, what is the
dance party?
Oh, it was a you go and dance to records on TV.
Like
it was
Dick
the
Clark.
American Bandstand of Columbus. Yeah. Hey,
we had
an American Bandstand. Jerry Razor.
I was
Razor.
On with my folk group, the Yeoman, back in the 60s.
I didn't know you had a folk group.
Along with, we were on Midwestern Hayride.
BBF was a big staple. I actually appeared on Lucy's Toy Shop when Lucy would go to the fair, and you'd have to tell Lucy you were the first person at the fair. And the BBF clown was there. It would have been about 1973 because I told Lucy that I was the first person at the fair. So I got a $20 gift booklet to
Lucy's
BBF.
Lucy's alive and well and lives in Granville, Susan Manicky. And I wonder if Jerry Razor's still alive.
I don't know. I was on Fern Sharp.
Oh my.
For Halloween, dressed as a cowgirl. And
we've digressed from food chat.
Popcorn, they threw popcorn balls. There was food there.
Well, could I plug the list, by the way? Yeah, we have there's a list of historic Columbus restaurants, and there's a new one up today. It's on
the blog.
WOSU.org/chefsinthecity, along with about 100 other restaurant reviews from Rich and Steve and Rich.
Looks as though it's exhaustive, or it was
exhausted. Well, I'm exhausted, but there are more. Today I've picked up about a dozen. It's just, it never ends.
Well.
So it's great fun, though. And it's great cocktail party and dinner party conversation. Mm-hmm. The first time this happened, we were at the Metropolitan Club.
Mm-hmm.
Doug and David and Rich Terapak and me, we were talking about the history of Columbus restaurants. And this spawned this list. And then we take it to a dinner party or even a cooking class when we teach. And everybody gets wildly enthusiastic and remembering all these great restaurants. And then almost everybody could add something to it.
Well, sure. I think restaurants are it's a place where people go to celebrate. It's a place where people go to get engaged. It's a place where people go to celebrate birthdays, celebrate graduation, celebrate weddings. So I think most people have lots and lots of very fond memories of the places that they would go.
The prom at Kahiki's.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Or all the politicians that would go to either the Claremont or out to Reeves. Reeves was another
the
big.
Neil House. Or
yeah, I mean,
the Neil House, yes. And Mario's International, right across the street from the State House. And the Galleria, Mario's was a fine dining restaurant. And Vern Reif and other politicos would hang out at the bar there.
Well, I rode up the old glass elevator to One Nation. I think it was one of the first times I went there. I grew up here. It would have been in the late 70s, early 80s. Going up to One Nation, and who should be in the glass elevator with me but Congressman Chalmers Wiley. Chalmers P. Wiley was there when I went up there. So,
we're talking about restaurants and the history of restaurants in Columbus with the authors of Lost Restaurants of Columbus, Doug Motes and Christine Hayes, along with Steve Stover. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call, 292-8513. Let's get back to some of these historic restaurants. Dybul's certainly comes to mind. I think that was still up and running when I got to town, and it was a restaurant that we used to go to. But it had a long and storied history.
Dybul's went through lots and lots of iterations. It was it was originally run by a hoster from the Hoster's brewing family, and it was—
And they had another restaurant.
And they, yeah, the Hoster.
Eventually.
Yeah. So the Dybul's is being run by this guy, Carl Hoster, and it was really interesting. Christine and I were trying to be really historically accurate up to turning the edits in, and I found this great shoe brush that says compliments of the William H. Dybul Cafe on East Schiller Street. So before it was Whittier Street, it got changed from Schiller Street. But it was a bowling alley. I mean, it was kind of a sports pub as well. In fact, if you go there now, it's better known today as Barcelona. There's actually the remains of part of a bowling alley in the main dining room area of Barcelona restaurant. But yeah, I mean, it was one of the places that you would go, went through several iterations. Then it began showing old movies in black and white, and then lots and lots of local musicians would come to play.
Esther Craw
was, you would say Dybul's, and the next thing out of anybody's mouth.
She was like
a
little fire plug.
City Jazz Band?
Yeah, Esther Craw was this really interesting lady. She was a World War II USO performer. They called her the accordion with legs. Because she would go up to the front lines and actually play for the soldiers during World War II. She married a guy from Columbus and came back here. She was originally from upstate New York. But yeah, you would pass the lay with Esther Craw, and the guys would be palm trees, and the women would be the hula dancers. And that got to be a little bit rowdy. There are stories in there about how I think it's the Wisconsin cheerleaders would come in. It was always a big time at Dybul's during OSU football games, and they were actually doing tumbling and cheers and dancing on the tables during that. Arnett Howard played there.
And Gene D'Angelo sort of got his start there. He was a musician at Dybul's.
They had the Hogshead Club too, which was kind of Dybul's really started out as this kind of a male dominated place. And then they would have this Hogshead Club where that's where they would actually eat, you know, fried hog and
saloon kind of
place. Yeah, that kind of thing and sandwiches.
Well, there were a lot of German drinking songs, I think, sung there as well in the olden days.
Well, and it was right across the street from the what was it, Athletic Park, where the OSU Buckeyes actually played their very first home football game. So there's a marker in the now it's the Giant Eagle parking lot that that talks about that. But yeah, I mean it was right across the street from a place where lots and lots of athletic events were going on.
And this started out as two buildings, right?
Mm-hmm. It started out as 259 and 261. For different time frames, at one point there was actually a Piggly Wiggly in part of the building.
Which is a grocery store.
Which is a grocery store. Then in the 60s, I've got the book in front of me, I could look at it. They opened up the very famous patio now that people know and people love the patio that's at Barcelona. Mm-hmm. They actually planted hops in the patio to help to decorate what the patio would be. So,
We're talking with Doug Motes and Christine Hayes, along with Steve Stover, about Lost Restaurants of Columbus. If you'd like to join us this morning, you can call 292-8513. What happened eventually with Dybbles?
Well, it's still – Dybbles became Barcelona. I mean,
it went through a couple of owners.
Lots of restaurants do that. There's ups and downs and in curves with things. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Kyle Katz. Am I wrong? Let me go to the book. Tell you what happened with that.
Well, there's always lawyers, landlords, insurance, partners, parking, and taxes. And then don't forget about building inspectors, health inspectors, prices of meat going up. I mean, there are so many factors. So you have the wonderful restaurateur, but he's got to have a whole bunch of good friends who are in the legal business and the food business. And
well, we've talked before on the show about that's one of the very important things about locally owned restaurants is that they do generate a lot of business for accountants, for lawyers, for insurance brokers, for all sorts of people.
Right. A lot of business is done in restaurants.
Well, that's true, too. But it's one good reason for people to support locally owned restaurants because they create so many jobs.
Nine Originals, Columbus.
Well, here it is. I mean, in one paragraph, in 1983, Tom Silcott had it. He sold Dybbles to three businessmen who in turn sold the place to Patricia Snodgrass in 1988. She ran it for 5 years, and then Bill Bigelow took it out of bankruptcy in 1993. Bill Bigelow had gone to college at OSU. He loved Ma Grundy's. He came back. Ma Grundy's is now better known as Planks on Parsons. And he had also run Chumley's in New York and interesting stuff. But, I mean, you get the sense of it. In 1996, Dybbles was shut down for good and then reopened under the name Barcelona, which has a
– 96?
96.
Okay.
Yeah, and Scott Heinlich is the ownership of it.
And, of course, Barcelona has a wonderful restaurant.
Yeah, Barcelona's fantastic.
And
people
love the patio. Fabulous patio.
Mm-hmm. And we don't want to include them in lost restaurants.
No.
We want them to survive.
Well, it's funny because I was working on the list last night in anticipation of this, and I had to put down Betty's. I had to put down L'Antibe, and I had to put down Rigsby's. I added all three to the list, and what a tragedy.
5 years
to do
ago,
that.
You wouldn't have thought.
No.
Yeah.
And in 2009, we lost Hankey's and Rosendale's at the same time, so...
I have to give a shout out to Hankey's because the Grumpy Gourmet has such a great thing to say about that. Can I just read this?
And he
real
writes
quick?
In all superlatives when he writes about.
Well,
it.
He does.
Yeah, it's the best meal he ever had.
Yeah,
for sure.
This is from Doral Chenna with the Grumpy Gourmet. Few restaurant reviewers can claim to have covered near perfection in every aspect in a single restaurant. In my travel, food, and restaurant writing career spanning more than 40 years, I can make such a claim. Hankey's cuisine in my city's brewery district is the perfect restaurant by my exacting standards, and that's extremely high praise.
I'm going to get another copy and run it up to Chef Hankey. Today. That's perfection.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Just beautiful.
I hope he
that.
Likes it.
He's still cooking. He's still doing some catering and I won't say how old he is because I don't know.
And these books are available at Acorn Bookshop, 1464 West Fifth Avenue in Grandview.
At Kitty Corner to the new sweet carrots too. So.
The new sweet carrot. And we're having a book launch there on December 14th, Monday, from 6 to 9 p.m.
Well, we should add that this book just came out, I think, November 30th.
Monday.
Yeah. And it's the only place it's available is at Acorn.
At this point, yes.
Because I tried last night.
2928513, Nancy has joined us from Worthington. Go ahead, Nancy.
You've brought back so many memories, I don't know where to start. First of all, I fondly remember Ben Hayes, and he was always very generous to me and to other would-be writers. And I really, really appreciated him.
I'm sure Christine enjoys hearing that.
Yeah, yes. I did too. I felt like I got to know him in doing the research.
Right. If you read his files, of course, there is the Ben Hayes scrapbook, a book I published of his works in 1991. And it's just like talking to him. He left such a legacy of history, and his personality is right there on the paper.
I loved him. I wanted to bring back a memory that nobody else remembers but me, and they think I'm making it up. before I mention my favorite restaurants, when I was just out of high school, I went to Worthington, 1971, my dad said he was taking mom to a nightclub to hear Mel Torme. And I said, well, what are you doing, taking her to Las Vegas? What are you talking about? And he said, no, it's over in Graceland. It's called Puka's Palace. Does anybody remember there was actually a nightclub at Graceland? Bobby Darin performed there, Phyllis Diller, Gregory Hines.
Spell it. Can you spell it?
Puka, like a puka shell.
P-U-K-A?
No, P-U-C-C-A, Palace.
Hmm.
I've and heard it was, of it, but I will have to research that for volume
well,
two.
I wanted to write about it.
That is obscure.
Because
that's
people
great.
Didn't believe me. And I happened to run into an older gentleman, and I asked him if he remembered it, and he said, yeah, I owned it. and he was a former owner of, what was Anton's restaurant?
Huh.
And he had grown up in Columbus, and he had this dream of one day having a nightclub, and it was in Graceland. And I said, you know, can you imagine the velvet fog over Graceland?
That would be Ann and Tony Fracasso, who
right?
owned Anton's.
Well, this was Joe.
Joe Fracasso.
Joe Fracasso had
okay.
Palace.
All right.
And it was there. It was short-lived from September to December of 71. And, I mean, Bobby Darin performed there, Al Martino.
Right there at Graceland.
Right there in Graceland, nobody, and so I started writing about it, but I've lost touch with Joe.
I love the story about.
Unfortunately, there were no pictures. He said that Jerry Beck's brother took all the pictures, but Jerry Beck is deceased, and I can't find the brother.
Okay.
And I think only an ad ran in the Dispatch, and you can't go and look for ads. You know, it's like they're not listed, so you have to go through all the microfilm.
Right.
And then, but I wanted to mention. When my parents married in 42, and of course, you know, they used to hang out at Larry's Bar and at the Blue Danube. But they also mentioned a restaurant called Dorsemans. Do you know anything about it?
Sure, Dorsemans in the book.
That's in the book, and I didn't know anything about it. What is it? Where is it? Where was it? Dorsams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was one of the two that I didn't know about.
And it was kind of an early restaurant in Columbus, as I recall from
and Hennix,
reading
that
about
was the
it.
Other one.
Oh, Hennix is great. Hennix was at in the campus area.
Okay.
But Dorsum's was God. I know we had. I know we talked about Dorsum's
because it's in the book because there's a it's,
a tiny a little yeah probably for the downtown. Here it is. Dorsum's was a couple of places. It was at 11 West Broad. It was 279 South High. It was like Benny Klein's The Crossroads of Columbus. It was a former gambling salon of Pat Mernon's. It had great hamburgers with dry slaw on them.
What
right. Dorsum's was very popular for its hamburgers, kind of like sliders. And Grumpy Gourmet tells the story that they had lots of onions on them, and people would grab those and then go to the movies across the street, and the whole movie theater would smell like onions.
I love the story about Mel Torme because he performed a lot, too, at the Merrimore, and he said Danny Deeds used to pay him off with Merrimore chocolates. So that was I love that Mel Torme was other places, too.
We are going to take a quick break here, and we will be back with Doug Motes, Christine Hayes, and Steve Stover on All Sides Weekend, Chefs in the City. We're back. I'm Marilyn Smith. This is All Sides Weekend, Chefs in the City. We're talking with Doug Motes, Christine Hayes, and Steve Stover about the lost restaurants of Columbus. Doug Motes and Christine Hayes are the authors of that newly published book. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. We were talking about some restaurants that had been here for a really long time, and you mentioned a place called Foresters, I think.
Foresters, which is the location of De Novo right now, but they still have kept the sign that says restaurant, the neon sign, and they do have pictures of the old Foresters, which was listed in the old directories as a confectionery because they had baked goods and candy and made all their own bread, but it was also a restaurant. And in the Forrester family for many, many years. It started in 1875 and was the longest opening under the same name for 120 years. I still have like a big clear glass candy jar from there because my father was good friends with one of the final owners. And I have four ice cream chairs from there.
Well,
and another one that we talk about that's really long-legged was Marzetti's from 1896. To about 1972. And
of course, they're still making salad dressings.
Oh, God, yeah. And yes. When Steve was singing the theme song.
May I? Yes, please.
If you must.
You ought to try Marzetti's for America's best dressed salads. Try Marzetti's famous dressings today.
That's lovely.
You're not smiling now.
I'm trying to control myself. And, of course, Marzetti's, there's some kind of strange stories about the history of the wife was a young woman.
Oh, she was really young. Yeah. So
from Italy.
Therese Marzetti, she came over. Her father had been here. Her father was working at a little saloon and a fruit stand on Gay Street, in fact. And sadly, he was Columbus's first trolley car accident. He jumped off the trolley and the trolley man said, you know, you shouldn't do that. And he did. And they took him away. And shortly thereafter, he passed away. But so he sent for the children were sent for. They came over from Italy to the United States. I think Teresa came over in 1892. She was just 13 years old at the time, a long sea voyage. She worked for a friend of the family, her uncle, for 4 years. And then another friend of the family was Mr. Marzetti, and he had just opened up a restaurant across the street from Ohio State University.
And he was much older.
He was 45 when they married, if memory serves, and she was 19. So, yeah, there was a little bit of a May-December romance. She started to work for him when she was 16 years old, kind of sweeping up and keeping things going. But a romance must have blossomed, and they had two daughters. And then Mr. Marzetti was kind of one of those guys that across the street from the university. He kind of took in kind of as an uncle or a father figure to a lot of university kids. And as he was beginning to get ill, because he passed away shortly after they had married, there was another gentleman that came in, Carl Schauffele. And he ends up marrying Teresa later on, and it's the opposite. Teresa is a little bit older than Carl. But there's another great story about that, because most people think, I think, of Marzetti's as being across the street from the State House, and it had a couple of locations. It was there. It was also on Gay Street, and that's where famously when James Thurber was a columnist for the Dispatch, he would go in to the Marzetti's on Gay Street and draw on the tablecloths and cartoon. But I love reading the stories from it. So being so close to the university, met from time to time, university folks would drop by, and President William Oxley Thompson, who was very popular in the day, would stop by for dinner. Once he came in to celebrate his birthday with a group of students and faculty who were part of the Sphinx Honorary Society. Teresa knew of his birthday in advance and decided to bake a cake for the popular president, Prexy, as he was called, that she would serve to him herself. So she carried the cake to present it to him, and just 3 feet shy of his table, she dropped it to the floor. President Thompson got up from the table, knelt to pick up a piece from the floor, and as he put it in his mouth, said, "A little dirt never hurt anybody," and proceeded to eat the cake, and the rest of the party followed suit and ate their desserts off Marzetti's floor, saving Teresa from a great deal
so
of embarrassment.
So the five-second rule was born.
Well, apparently, during that time frame.
But it has nothing to do with the salad dressings.
No, nothing. Well, the salad dressings, it's kind of a cool story about the young lady who came. She was up from the South, and she was at a church, and she was looking for work. And they said that Marzetti's needed somebody to help sweep up the floor.
So she came. Cakes and other things.
Yeah, apparently of all kinds of other things. And Catherine Hill. And so she did that. And halfway through that, then she got a regular job, and she was washing dishes and doing things. But Carl had asked her to bake pies, and she couldn't bake the pies. So she prayed to God, and overnight she figured out how to bake pies. And then after that, he asked her to develop some salad dressings. And that's where the famous Marzetti salad dressings begin, from this African-American lady who had come up from the South and was just a kitchen to help and doing dishes and kind of helped build an empire of Marzetti salad dressing.
Yes. I won't sing it again.
We want to shout out to all the people who worked in all those kitchens and didn't get any credit for their recipes.
No notice.
Mary Pegg at Merrimore. I think of Betty Parker Brown, who is behind the Whirling Satellite at BBF, and Catherine Hill. I mean, the great thing to me, or the great revelation to me in studying all this, was what a place it was for women to succeed in business. It really was an avenue that was open to ladies in a time frame where there weren't a lot of avenues for
it was still very much male-dominated.
Yeah, but it's, a lot of it started at Lazarus. From the Metropolitan.
Oh, Mary Love with the Merrimore, absolutely. She was brought in by the Lazarus family to run the cafes that became the tea rooms. The tea room was born there. And then she struck out on her own, and Mary Love was her name. So they contracted it, Mary Amour, French for love, to the Merrimore.
And that was a very famous restaurant here.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, it was Duncan Hines. I mean, long before he was a cake mix, Duncan Hines was kind of the Arbiter of American food
he
and
was
what
a food
was
critic.
Good. Oh, he was a big-time food critic. There's another great story about the Marimore when we talk about that, that he came in and he would love to go to the Marimore. He was always happy when his travels brought him into Columbus. I mean, Gertrude Stein and Alice Toklas ate at the Marimore, and they said that, you know, because they were friends with Alice Schilly, famous Columbus watercolorist who was friends with Mary Love. In fact, Alice Schilly had some of her very first one-woman shows at the Marimore before they even went to the Columbus Gallery of Fine Arts. Alice Toklas and Gertrude Stein collected her work in Paris. They came to visit, and they said that the cooking at the Marimore would be the envy of their Paris salon. So, I mean, that's pretty high praise.
How good was the food back then? Now we talk about farm-to-table, fresh food, food in season. But how good was it?
It tasted very good to me. I think it was very fresh. I think they did make sure that things came. The big thing about the seafood was that it wasn't frozen, that it came on ice. That was Tom Johnson's seafood restaurant. That was a big thing back then. And oysters were a real craze. There was an oyster garden on top of the Southern Hotel. And so there were many, many oysters and shrimp and seafood eaten.
But it was before the time of all this processing. That
right,
started really
exactly.
in the 50s with your
and
TV
were making
dinners and frozen
scratch.
Dinners and yeah. packaged and processed and salted. So it probably my memories were, you know, the Explorers and the Faculty Club at Ohio State. The
There's an interesting
really
recipe
good.
That we found for Marimore cream chicken, and it was handwritten. We have it at the Columbus Historical Society, and it's not in the book, but it's really great. It says, start with a young fryer, not a long-legged thing. You know, and then they also talk about the cream that you're going to use. Be certain that you use the top third out of the bottle. So, I mean, it's, you know, even the recipes then and what right. they're doing is super local because it really has to be. And they're talking about very specific types of, you know, game to use. So,
quality really was at the center of what they were doing.
Well, I think these finer restaurants, yes.
Especially for Mary Love. And then, of course, Mary Pegg, who kind of took over for Mary Love and then went on to become the dispatch food critic. She had a regiment for everything that was served at the Marimore.
We're going to take a call from Ron. Good morning. Ron, are you with us? Well, apparently he's moved on. We did get an email from John in Dublin. He said he lived in Columbus in 1986, and he loved L'Armagnac. And when he came back in 2005, voila, there was no L'Armagnac. That was a really special restaurant downtown. Tell us a little bit about the history of that one.
It was made to look like a little French...
And it did.
Yeah, a little French chateau downtown. I think a lot of politicos went there, and it was... are you finding a page?
Yeah, well, it was Dale Gussett's restaurant, who then goes on to do L'Antibes.
Yes.
So, in fact, we have one of the recipes of Dale's in the book for some, I think it's sweetbreads. That's the great thing about the book is besides telling the stories, we were able to incorporate a baker's dozen of, we have a Marimore fudge recipe. We have Marzetti's minestrone soup recipe. We've got sweetbreads from L'Armagnac. We've got sauerbraten from
surprise.
Reeves.
I didn't know that there were recipes back here.
We've got the Clarmont's pepper steak, highlight herb butter. So you could things from Carolyn. We have the scallops, the lime scallops from Carolyn City Park. So
there was also another offshoot of L'Armagnac, and that was Tom Johnson and John Bessie, who also morphed it into. Galantine's up in Westerville.
And John Bessie used to cook, I think, along with Tom Johnson at Lindy's.
And he was also
and they
the
did
front
brunch
of the house.
On Saturday or Sunday.
And now he's a judge.
Well, I mean, that was one of the interesting things, too, in doing the research. How many chefs would go from place to place? Like Carolyn Claycomb was one of Chef Hanke's chefs. Or Don Houck, who was a fantastic chef at One Nation, then went on to Out on Main.
And Refectory.
And we include Don Houck's turkey cakes, which were his version of crab cakes. As another one of the recipes that's in the book.
And don't forget Elena.
Oh, God, yeah. So, I mean, yeah. There's a great story about Carolyn Claycomb and Chef Hanke going to David Peltzman's when he had David's on Main. And again, David was this kind of character. And they both went after the restaurants had closed because they wanted to find out about this place, David's on Main. And they showed up in their chef's whites. And David Peltzman turned them away because chef's whites were not allowed in the restaurant.
Yeah. Now, how long has Elena's been open?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, Elena's is great.
I thought it was a 15th anniversary party that she had a year or two ago.
Elena started with the Historical Supper Club series with the Columbus Historical Society, which is another kind of influence. And
I encountered her with a giant wok doing incredible food at Glass Axis parties. This was amazing.
Two others I just thought of that aren't your classic restaurants, but Thurn's, Al Thurn's down on Greenlawn Avenue. I think they're now 130 years old. Always in the family. And in another twist, the private club, the Columbus Club, I think will celebrate its 130th anniversary.
Well, Resch's, Resch's did all the rolls and cakes for Reeb's Restaurant, is still in existence. They moved down the street, Livingston Avenue, into Whitehall, but they started in 1912, so they've been around now 103 years or so.
And the Dell, which was in a kind of unusual location, maybe not when it originated, but as Parsons and Oak became a little more run down, it was kind of an iffy place to go.
Right. The Grumpy Gourmet said once there was a shooting next door, so they locked the doors and gave everybody a free pitcher of beer there. But that was just one of its incarnations. It seemed to have multiple owners, and there was an apartment upstairs that was famous or infamous. And
was it always there? Was it always on Parsons and
Oak? Yes. It's always been in the same location, but it's had numerous...
down from the what is now the Black Creek.
And always very musical, too. They were
they had
lots
a lot of
sing-alongs.
Of live,
yes,
know,
there are lots of good memories about singing along at the piano.
And at one of the iterations, it was a tapas bar, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yes.
That was recent.
Yes, that was Susan Singh. That was her idea to have the tapas bar. Uh-huh.
And German Village has always been a popular place for restaurants. Talk a little bit about the place upstairs.
Oh, that was one of the African-American men who was an athlete. And he was very tired of his job as an engineer, I believe it was.
Earl Bradley.
And he said, well, I'm just going to start a restaurant. So he got in some church pews and dressed everybody in kind of old-fashioned long skirts, who the wait staff, that would be the females, and created a place. Now, there's someone who's like a restaurateur that wanted to be out there and talking to his customers.
Front of the house,
absolutely.
But there was also the Marble Gang that go on to do the Glory Foods. And there was Brownstone on Main. There was David's on Main. Then there was Out on Main. And then there was Brownstone on Main. So, I mean, there's...
David's was first.
David's was first. Then was Out on Main, which was award-winning, not only for its cuisine, but for being kind of... It's in the themed area for being a celebration of the lesbian, gay, transgendered, bisexual community. And they had lots of artifacts. It was kind of like a...
museum.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, they had some really great things. They had some wonderful nods to Columbus in there as well, the community room. But the food there was, I think, what was really quite wonderful. And then they also had a foundation where they would give different monies back to organizations
as
well.
Don Houck was there too, wasn't he?
Don Houck went to there. Yeah, that was when it was ownership of Michael Cavan and Tom Grody. Tom Grody of the Donato's Pizza family. So,
yep.
We just have about 2 minutes left. My husband recently had been asking me about the waterworks. Do you remember the waterworks? We used to go to the watering. But he couldn't remember where it was. And voila, out comes your book. And you placed it under the parking lot of Nationwide.
Yeah. Yes, that's where it used to be.
It was quite a unique...
You could dine
place.
In a bathtub.
Yep.
The menu is served. We actually have a menu. I should have brought it with me. It's actually on.
It's very heavy. It's like a manhole cover.
It's a manhole cover. There are pictures of it.
Probably not stolen.
There's a picture in the book.
There's a picture in the book. And the recipes and the things that you would order from it were pretty crazy. Here's one of them. You could get the saltwater station scampi or the skewer pipe or the main pipeline, get the seaboard substation or the Colorado Aqueduct. You could get for a dessert, you could get a flowing smoothly, apparently, a cheesecake.
But this was never a water processing plant or anything.
No,
like that. It was just a highly themed.
Yeah,
it was theme.
You would dine in the bathtub was its big thing. So
it was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
Well, yeah. But at the same time, when we think of themed restaurants, Max and Irma's had telephones at the tables before you could do that.
Yeah.
And you could call. I was always in trouble because I grew up in Reynoldsburg, and there was one that was right behind Livingston and Bryce, and I would be calling to the other tables and getting in trouble.
So you call the other tables. It wasn't as though you were calling in your order.
Right.
That's right. That was before cell phones.
Thank you both so much. Thank you, Steve, as well. This hour has gone much too quickly. We'll have to do this again. Christine Hayes and Doug Motes, who are the authors of Lost Restaurants of Columbus. Steve Stover writes for our blog, Chefs in the City at WOSU.org. I'm Marilyn Smith. We will be back again in January.